Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. For generations, Americans have taken it as a given that buying a home is both a solid financial investment and a critical part of fulfilling their American dream. But we know that many of you out there in your 20s, 30s, and 40s are having a quiet conversation and asking, is that still the case for our generation? And we know it's a terrifying question. Thankfully, Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post, dare to ask that question out loud this week. Is this generation of potential homeowners the first generation for which buying a home isn't a no-brainer? She wrote up some interesting data in her column this week and joins us now. Hi, Catherine. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here.
You start out your column by citing two studies that show that Americans, even 5 years into the housing-fueled Great Recession, still think of buying a home as the most sound long-term financial investment. It comes out ahead of mutual funds and bonds and so on. Does the data refute that assumption?
I don't know that I would outright say it refutes that assumption, but it certainly questions it. If you look at the long-term gains, the long-term returns to homeownership over the last several decades, over the last century, not even just, you know, in the year since the housing bust, when obviously it was a very risky asset. In the years when it seemed very safe, the annual gains to housing are a little bit less than 1%, which is not a great return. And that number is also not taking into account the costs of homeownership, things like property taxes and maintenance and various other expenses, homeowners insurance. So, you know, a home is a good place to live. I think it brings a lot of people a lot of joy for many reasons and a sense of security. But it's not as if it's going to make you rich, at least if you look at the historical numbers.
It's certainly counterintuitive when you look at the data and think of the way we tend to experience these things. You write that, quote, over the past century, housing prices have grown at a compound annual rate of just over 0.3%. Once one adjusts for inflation. Over the same period, the S&P 500 stock index has a comparable annual return of about 6.5%. So that's way less than 1% to more than 6.5% to more than 6% stocks versus owning a home. And yet Americans still think it's financially savvy and more financially safe. Do you think that's because of the particular experience of one generation, the post-World War II generation, which, you know, bought homes all over, certainly all over the metro area for $30,000, $60,000 in the 1950s and 60s, and now they're worth hundreds of thousands or a million?
I think it's partly that. Your memory kind of plays tricks on you, I think. I actually spoke with the Nobel laureate Robert Shiller at Yale, who's done a lot of work on housing. You know, he won a Nobel for his work on asset prices and things like that, but he kind of became a household name in the last decade or so because he called the housing bubble pretty early. And I talked with him about this. I said, so why is it that, you know, despite the data, people seem so attached to this idea that housing is a really good investment? And he said one of the explanations that he gave anyway was that people remember very vividly the amount of money that they paid for their home, as you mentioned. You know, you can ask them, how much did you pay for your home? And it could have been 50 years ago. And it was such a large, emotional, significant purchase that that number sticks with them. And it might be something, you know, like $30,000. So they remember that. They look at what house prices have done today and they say, geez, house prices have gone up so much, not really thinking about the fact that prices overall have risen tremendously during that time. You know, they're not sort of doing the mental calculation for inflation. And because that price sticks out, you know, that their home price sticks out in their mind, they're making this comparison that's a little bit unfair in a way that they may not remember, you know, what the S&P 500 looked like 50 years ago. They may not remember what was in their savings account 50 years ago. But because that price, that home price number is so salient that that kind of sticks out in their mind and gives them this very vivid image of, wow, you know, this investment has really turned out well.
So listeners, if you're in this boat right now, call in with the questions that you're asking yourself. Are you thinking about buying a home? Maybe you're a young single or in a young couple, about to have kids, you recently had kids. You're deciding, should I buy a home or should I just keep on renting? Should I even consider renting as a permanent condition for my life because that's actually financially advantageous? 212-433-WNYC. Do you think you're having this conversation in a different way than your parents might have? 212-433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Or if you recently bought a home, let's say if you bought a home in the last 10 years, just before, just after the financial crisis, do you regret it? 212-433-9692 for Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell. Of course, Catherine, this comparison that we're making between buying a home and the S&P 500, the alternative to owning stocks is not owning stocks, but the alternative to owning a house or a home is renting. So you're making a monthly financial commitment either way. And
right.
The conventional wisdom is either you're putting it into equity that you'll eventually get back someday or can borrow on or whatever, or you're, you know, flushing it down the toilet into the pocket of your landlord.
Right. And this is a very important point. I think what people don't realize is that monthly mortgage payments are still generally much higher than monthly rent payments. When you're paying for your mortgage, when you're paying to buy your home, you're sort of paying two separate things that are bundled together. One is the right to live there. That's effectively the rent. You know, how much would it cost to live in an equivalent home, equivalent size and quality home, if you weren't, you know, if you weren't trying to get your name on the deed, basically, if you were just renting it. And then the other is basically the right to take a bet on whether the home's value is going to increase at the end of the 30-year mortgage or however long the mortgage is. So yes, you are paying – when you pay your mortgage payment, you are getting the benefit of living there. But in an alternative scenario, you could say, okay – let's say I try to rent a place that is equally sized, equally nice, and I use that difference between what I would have paid in my mortgage bill every month and the slightly lower rent that I'm paying for the rental home, and I invested that in the stock market or some other asset that's much more diversified. What happens then? And, you know, generally speaking, you still come out ahead. It really depends on what market you're in. You know, if you had bought on the west side of Manhattan in the early 80s rather than rented, you'd be doing very well today. You know, once upon a time, that neighborhood didn't look so nice, and now it's quite expensive. You could say the same thing for the Mission District in San Francisco. But not necessarily for, you know, Detroit or Cleveland or a lot of places where home values have not kept up. And it's very hard to tell ex ante where that good investment is going to be. If you look at the overall average numbers, you know, what the median home price was in the country in, you know, 1982, and the median what's called imputed rent for that home, that's mm-hmm. like, a you know, the equivalent of how much it would cost to rent that place. And you said, okay, if I bought it outright versus if I rented it and then invested, you know, the $70,000, which is about what the median home cost back then, if I had invested that in the S&P 500, where would I come out? And, you know, again, on just this sort of median home, you'd come out better if you had invested it elsewhere.
Mm, and paid your rent.
And paid your rent.
You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, as we talk about the new calculation between renting and owning. And Adam in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Adam.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to say, you know, I am recently married, and my wife and I have been looking for a home for about the past year. I still really believe that it's important for middle-class Americans to own a home. If people like my wife and myself don't own these homes, somebody will. And, you know, rather than just pay rent, which I do feel like I'm throwing the money away every month, and we're currently paying $1,600 a month for a one-bedroom apartment, you know, we figured out to get a home, our mortgage is going to be somewhere around $2,000 to $2,400 a month for something that works for us. But again, there is a value there, and I still feel that it's the cornerstone of a middle-class lifestyle in this country, and it's a marker that I still think people are judged by.
So there's something for you beyond the financial calculation. There's a question of status. You said something people are going to be judged by, and something beyond that that relates to a notion of being a grown-up in a way in America. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, absolutely. And the other thing here is, again, are we going to become a society of, and it gets to class disparity to a certain degree, where, you know, again, these properties are going to be owned one way or another. And the question is, are they going to be owned by the people who are occupying them, which are going to allow those people to build equity and, you know, hopefully someday fund for retirement? Or are they going to be owned by investors who are already mm-hmm. rich and who are already profiting? And are we just going to
right.
keep, you know, lining their pockets?
Do we want to live in landlord nation? But did you
exactly.
do the kind of number crunching for yourself that Catherine was just going through for the hypothetical family that would or would not have bought in the average American city in the 1980s? Did you look down the road and say, okay, I'm going to be sinking X into this home that I'm looking to buy in mortgage payments and in maintenance, as compared to if I was renting the equivalent space and keeping that extra, because it's cheaper to rent than to buy, keeping that extra and putting it in the stock market for the next 30 years of my life? I mean, have you crunched it like that for yourself?
We did, and we looked at it actually in two different ways. Part of the issue, at least in Westchester, is inventory. I don't want to raise, you know, again, we're a newly married couple. I don't want to raise my family in an apartment building. I want them to have a yard to play in.
You could rent a house. There are plenty of houses for rent, right?
There's not. And that's my second point. And again, the prices, the houses that are for rent in Westchester, the prices are equivalent to a mortgage,
uh-huh.
essentially. You know, you're looking for a two-bedroom to a three-bedroom house in Westchester, anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 a month, which falls in line, basically,
with the mortgage payments.
And
Adam, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much. And Catherine, he raises a very important point here, a couple. One is, do we want to live in landlord nation, where if you're advising every average person to be a renter rather than an owner, then we're all going to be subservient, if that's the right word, or, you know, indentured to in some way this landlord class that we would be empowering. And
but you might be richer.
But you might
You might be richer, so I don't know how that makes you indebted to them.
Right.
You know, I think there are a few different things that came up in that conversation. You know, one is the sort of emotional and tangible social benefits of home ownership. You know, the idea that it's a key to the American dream, to being a member of the middle class, to being seen as a grown-up, in your words. And I think that those are all completely legitimate and important reasons to own a home.
And what about – go
yes.
ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the issue is, you know, that people derive a lot of these, let's call them psychic benefits as opposed to financial benefits from
uh-huh.
home ownership.
Right.
But they also overstate the financial benefits. And as a result, they're probably buying more house than actually makes them happy. You know, I hear this from a lot of people who are new homeowners in the last few years when I've been covering economics, that people say, I want to own. You know, I like the idea of having my own property. I thought I would get a two-bedroom or whatever. But look, I qualified for a five-bedroom. I might as well get that. And I think that there's this idea that because the financial benefits are supposedly so great, and besides, you know, there are tax incentives that sort of push you in this direction too, that I should sort of consume as much housing as I can, with people not remembering that this is one asset. You're sinking a lot of money into that one asset, which bears risk. You know, you're not diversifying. And you're tying up all of your savings or much of your savings there, and you're leaving these sort of opportunity costs on
mm-hmm.
the table. That maybe you can still get the benefit of homeownership, but at a home that actually fits your needs and makes you happy without buying all the extra, you know, the extra bedrooms and the extra land, and you could use the money you would have spent on that to invest on in something else.
What about the distinction that he made between people who want to live in an apartment and people who want to live in a house? I have a friend who's selling a really nice house in a really nice part of Westchester, and she can't believe that it's only like $600,000, which, you know, is not that much compared to what she paid for it decades ago, compared to the little apartment that you know, people are selling in New York City for $1 million, and saying so if he's looking to compare mortgage to rental in the suburbs, they're actually much closer than they would be in the city. Plus, there aren't houses for rent the way there are apartments for rent.
So I have two thoughts on that. One is that just comparing the mortgage to the rental price is still not sufficient. I mean, I think in most functional markets, you'll see that the rental prices should be a little bit lower because, again, you're paying just for the right to live there, as opposed to with the mortgage, you're paying for the right to live there plus the right to own it plus the interest. But even that, even if they are equivalent, you know, you're still not taking into account property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You're not taking into account maintenance. You know, if you want to keep up the value of the
mm-hmm.
home,
right.
You know, not just for yourself because you have to live there, but
right.
because you think you might want to resell it at some point, that costs a lot of money. You know, the rule of thumb that I've heard is anywhere between 1% and 4% of the value of the home that you have to spend in maintenance, although obviously it varies greatly. So there are a lot of other costs.
And there aren't a lot of nice houses for rent, at least not today.
Yes.
Until your vision of a new American housing market comes to pass, there just aren't a lot of nice houses for rent for families who want to live in a nice house, right?
I mean, yeah, so that's part of the issue. It's that because this country has been so oriented towards home ownership as opposed to rentals, you know, you sort of have this self-fulfilling prophecy that you don't have a lot of nicer home rentals on the market, you know, that are equivalent to the places you can buy. That's not true in all markets, especially in a lot of areas that were hit pretty badly by the housing bust, in places like Las Vegas and in Phoenix and parts of California. You know, a lot of investors have bought up homes and turned them into rentals.
Right.
So you could have, you know, a housing development where every house looks the same, but some of them are for rent and some of them are to buy. But again, that's sort of an unintended consequence of the fact that we tried to make home ownership so easy for everyone that now you have this result where you have a lot of nicer housing that was built up initially as places to own that then people realized they could not afford to own that are now falling into the rental category.
Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell reassessing the calculation between renting and owning a home in America. And Michael, who moved from New York to Mobile, Alabama. Is that right, Michael?
That's right. I left about 7 years ago, but as I was telling you, screener, once you've heard Brian Lehrer and WNYC, you get addicted.
All right.
To the internet.
I'm glad you're still listening. And you're starting to sound like a Southerner, Michael. I hear that little lilt.
Actually, I grew up in the South, moved to New York, and then came back basically to try and help out with Katrina recovery in New Orleans and just stayed down here. Anyway, obviously, I'm not talking about the New York market. But I think maybe part of the problem of what led to the housing crisis is to look at housing as, quote-unquote, an investment. How much money am I going to get out of this? For me, owning a house is about a sense of security, a sense of stability, a sense of privacy. I'm an amateur musician. You know, I'd like to be able to have enough space to invite some musicians over and practice without people banging on walls.
They say that's what Williamsburg is for. No, I'm just kidding. Michael, thank you very much. And Ken on Twitter isn't buying this argument. He writes us, rent goes up with inflation while mortgage payments go down, plus interest is deductible. So there's the tax equation, too. Have you taken all of that into account, Catherine?
I think, look, I can't speak for every single person's financial decision here. Rent goes up, yes, but, you know, mortgage payments are pretty substantial. And like I said, property taxes go up, too. As do maintenance costs. You have an older home, it's going to cost more to maintain it over time. So, you know, you buy a new house in 1980s, let's say, and maybe your maintenance costs are minimal, but over time, there's all that upkeep. The place has gotten more use, and those kind of costs rise too. I mean, I think there are a lot of factors that go into this calculation. And my point is just that we need to be skeptical of this idea that you buy a home and it is absolutely the way to get rich. If not to get rich, it's the best way, at least the safest investment for your money that brings a decent return. And if you look at alternate ways you could be investing at least some of the money that gets tied up in your house, if you're spending all of your money on your house, you might be better off.
Matt.
So, yes.
So Matt in Queens, you're on WNYC. Matt, what's your story?
Good morning, Brian.
Hi, Matt.
Hi. Okay, so my story is that my wife and I call her my wife, we're getting married next week. We live in Elmhurst, and we pay pretty reasonable rent for New York City. We have a very good living arrangement in our one-bedroom apartment. But we're worried that we're going to get priced out of our neighborhood, and that's really the only reason why we've even been talking about buying. Because we have no interest in homeownership. We're just worried about, being priced out. We're deeply skeptical about costs and taxes and everything else that comes with it. And not to mention the idea that if there's some sort of a terrorist attack and our apartment is irradiated, where would we then go? So for people who think that can't happen, 9/11 happened. So all of these things are going through my head, and I think this is one of the best topics we could possibly have on the show ever.
Well, if you like this topic, I refer you to our coming special on May 6th, which is going to be 2 hours on renting. We're going to do a special on rent coming up on Tuesday, May 6th program. But Matt, thank you for your experience. And so there's a particularly New York experience, right? And a particularly New York set of fears, Catherine, and maybe Washington too, where you live. But on the one hand, I'm going to own this thing. And then if, you know, the dirty bomb hits, it's going to be irradiated and I'm going to be stuck with it. On the other hand, how not to get gentrified out of the neighborhood that he's been living in is to buy there now while he can afford the asking price rather than sit with the inflating rents and lose it in a few years.
I would say actually that some of those concerns are not specific to New York. I mean, New Yorkers may be more concerned about terrorist attacks, but there are lots of other, you know, unforeseen acts of God that could happen that could wipe your home off the map that are caused by nature, for example. You know, you could this is true in New York. You know, we had Hurricane Sandy.
Right.
When was that? Last year? 2 years ago, I guess, at this point. Right? Yes, 2 years ago at this point, almost.
Getting there.
A lot of people lost their homes then. You know, this happens in other parts of the country, too, because of hurricanes, because of floods, because of whatever, because of fires. You know, when you own the home, you bear the risk, whether it's something that's a major storm or, you know, your roof collapses or whatever. So you are taking on these additional risks because you own the place. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you're renting, your landlord is at least supposed to make sure that you have hot water and that sort of thing.
Let me get one more story on the table here because it really is going to place it, I think, in our metro area in a different way. Kurt in Rivervale, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I just want to say I'm a huge fan of your show, Brian. I love it.
Thank you.
My question is I'm in process of moving out of a house that I've lived in all my life. In Rivervale, the property taxes is close to $12,000 a year, and I simply can't afford living there by myself anymore. I'm purchasing or have purchased a condominium, and for the cost of property taxes, I'm now going to be putting that money into a mortgage and getting equity back rather than just having that money go to all kinds of services and things like that. So where your focus has been mostly about being a homeowner versus renting an apartment, I'm just curious how you would compare being a homeowner to a condo owner, where a lot of those problems and things like that I really don't have to worry about
right.
anymore.
It's such a great question. And again, it's such a New York question or any metro area kind of question. Does the calculation change? You know, some people say, oh, you're going to spend all that money on a co-op or a condo, and then you're going to have the maintenance on top of it, which is akin to rent on top of the mortgage. On the other hand, if the pipes burst, he calls the landlord. He doesn't have to figure out how to be a plumber or pay a plumber. And, you know, and it's a different kind of lifestyle, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually that's the move that a lot more people should be making across the country, that when the home that they've owned forever, even if they've paid down the mortgage, becomes somewhat of a nuisance for them, you know, to maintain, to pay for, that they should be downsizing, whether that means that they're downsizing to a rental place or to a place that they're buying. I think really depends on how much value they place on the benefits of either, whether it's, you know, like what we were talking about, some sense of security and ownership that is very valuable to people, versus the flexibility of being a renter and being able to move. You know, I think a lot of that comes down to sort of personal preferences as opposed to mm-hmm. the financial benefits. But the fact that that Americans are thinking about these types of things and thinking about downsizing, I think, is important, precisely because a lot of them are not getting the full value of the home that they are having to pay for.
In the post-McMansion era, Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post, discussing her piece this week, reassessing the choice that young Americans this generation are being faced with between renting and owning. We've linked to her piece at WNYC.org. And Catherine, you've started a fascinating discussion here. I'll just wrap it up by reading a tweet from Nikki with another wrinkle, that the link between property taxes and schools, writes Nikki, means renters may not be invested in their neighborhood as much. So some of those structural elements would have to change to see Catherine Rampell's vision come true, writes Nikki, and something to follow up on in 2 weeks. And yes, folks, the lines are full. We could keep going with this. The comments page is hopping. People are tweeting and Facebooking us. So keep going on all of that among each other. And consider this kind of a teaser, because the week after next, Tuesday, May 6th, we'll do a full two-hour special, a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on renting. Catherine, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.